You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, let me get you.
The bubble's there.
What am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear, I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
Try him out on the train!
I don't know who you are.
Why so sick?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Assemble.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
If they call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No! What?
Everyone!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great couple of weeks. I finally fully recovered from the Bachelorette weekend just in time to gear up for the actual wedding for my sister, so not going to stay recharged for very long. What else did I do? I also got out of the house and saw Taylor Tomlinson do stand-up at the Pantages like last weekend, which was really fun. She's really great comedian, so if you get a chance to do that, highly recommend it. We had a great time. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got a few. Evil Dead Rise, The Pope's Exorcist, and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. First, Evil Dead Rise, which I absolutely loved. It was gory, it was scary, it didn't drag on and on and on. It's only like 90 minutes. You got in, you got scared, you went home. My only gripe, and I've not done a lick of research on it, so this is just my opinion, but it didn't, the movie didn't feel like an Evil Dead movie necessarily. It kind of felt like the studio just took a general horror script that had been submitted to them and then just kind of added a couple things to make it be an Evil Dead film. Like the elements that are, you know, historically Evil Dead, like the book or the chainsaw, were just kind of, they felt like they were just kind of substituted for other things and kind of felt like glued in at the last minute. I'm kind of just overthinking a good thing, but that was just my only gripe with it. Otherwise, very good, very scary. If that's your thing, get on it. Then there was The Pope's Exorcist. That was fine. If you like watching Russell Crowe pretend to be a priest on a Vespa, or if you've got any kind of Catholic trauma, this movie will speak to you. I've certainly seen worse films in the whole like priest exorcising demons genre, and this one at the very least was watchable, so I'll give it that. You can wait till streaming though. It's not worth seeing in the theater, in my opinion, which, as you all know, pains me to say. And finally, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which was a improvement to the otherwise continued rut that Marvel films seem to be in. Based on what I've been reading, I think I'm a little bit more in the minority here. I didn't think it was that great. It does stand up very well against like Thor 4 and The Last Ant-Man. It's definitely better than those. But I couldn't help but notice that like Thor 4, Ant-Man, and now Guardians, they were basically the same movie, just kind of jumbled up a little bit. Like they all even had like similar elements. Like they're all like, you know, we're weird aliens. We've got funky children or special children or just children, like a weird group of children that need to be saved. Like two of them had that. Whole bunch of aliens, like cheeky little like alien animals. Like they all had kind of the same like three or four things going on. And they all had almost the exact same theme, which is like identity, because they're all, you know, conceivably wrapping up their time in the MCU for at least the time being. Once I kind of noticed that, I couldn't get over that. Maybe it's just me being overly analytical for a popcorn movie, but that was my major gripe. Also, you know, James Gunn makes Guardians what it is, but I felt like he was stretched a little thin because he's, you know, heading up DC right now, or the film division anyway. And it felt like he was not around enough, especially in the editing, because the editing is not good. The story editing specifically was a little bit messy. There were some pretty big plot holes in there, and I tend to expect more from James Gunn. Again, it's better than Thor 4 and The Last Ant-Man, but, you know, it should have been way, way better than either of those. Hopefully Marvel figures their stuff out, because my popcorn movie joy has been seriously compromised of late because of whatever the hell they're doing over there. Also, Renfield is good if you want to maybe go see that. No particular reason as to why, but I cannot review it because I have never followed up on whether or not I should be doing that because of the company I work for. Now that I've droned on for about 6.5 minutes of this unedited, let's get on to this month's topic. As of the day of recording this episode, the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, has been on strike since Tuesday, May 2nd at 12:01 a.m. Right now, Hollywood is experiencing its first major strike in 15 years, but this is hardly the first time this has happened in Hollywood. This month, we're covering the foundations of the unions in Hollywood and three of the biggest strikes that have occurred. This week, we'll look into why the Hollywood unions formed, take a look at some of the strikes that occurred in the past affecting film and television directly. There are others that there's like the commercial actors have gone on strike. There was a musician strike back in like the 40s, I believe. Doesn't really pertain to what this podcast is about, so we're not going into those. And I'll also explain at the end of the episode kind of what's going on with the current WGA strike as of today, as I'm recording this, May 6th. So with that, let's take our places. It's showtime. Imagine that you're a part of a brand new, booming industry that's making tons of people rich, but you, a worker on the ground who's actively making that major product that's making other people rich, and yet you can barely feed your family. So strange, right? She said sarcastically. This was the reality of the stagehands and crew members of early cinema. Tinseltown has always been especially notorious for work-life imbalances, poor pay, and horrific work conditions, and this was, and in many cases is still, a very prevalent issue in Hollywood, especially early Hollywood. Naturally, many crew workers wanted to ensure they were getting their fair share for their contributions to this thing that was making all these men obscenely wealthy, and took actions to ensure that this would happen. Before we get any further into this, just in case, let's go into what a union is exactly. At the most basic level, a union is a group of individuals of similar skill sets or occupations that come together to form a single entity or group to protect the interests of all of its members. This month, we'll be focusing on two different kinds of unions for the most part. First, there's labor unions, which are an organization that represents a group of workers in collective bargaining negotiations with employers to improve wages, working conditions, and other employment-related issues. This is your IOTC workers, mainly in the modern industry. We'll also be, frankly, mostly because most of the strikes involve the writers, looking at trade unions, which represent a specific trade or industry, such as your writers and actors, or outside of film, think like plumbers and electricians, for example. Trade unions also work to protect the interests of workers in that specific trade. So IOTC can feature several different kinds of job people, like carpenters. I think costumes are in there. Animation is in there. But like the guilds just specifically focus, like WGA is the writers. Directors is the directors, but also the director's department, basically. It's like your ADs, your unit production managers. Producer guild is the producers. You get it. When a group of workers unionize, they form a collective bargaining unit that has the power to negotiate with their employers for better wages, benefits, working conditions, etc. By organizing, workers can leverage their collective strengths and they'll have a bargaining power to achieve better terms of employment than they would be if they were all going to the studios individually. So basically, if you piss a union off, you collectively piss off the entire group of people with that job description, which if you'd like to make a movie, you really can't afford to do. In the case of the studios and the showbiz unions, the studios recognize certain unions and guilds as the ones they'll bargain with when it comes to workers' concerns. This includes IOTC, WGA, DGA, and SAG-AFTRA. I'll tell you what all those mean later. The studios and producers don't all go to the table individually, though. They are members of something called a trade association, which bargains on their behalf. For American show business, this is done by the AMPTP, or the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, who take the studio side in contract deliberations. Every few years, contract length varies from union to union. The AMPTP will begin negotiations with a union who will send a group of representatives to hash out an agreement that should mutually benefit all parties for the next X amount of years. Sometimes this goes well, but in the case of everything we'll be covering this month, other times it doesn't. Talks break down and a strike is called. This has happened for a number of reasons, including issues with compensation, healthcare benefits, and residual payments for continued use of an artist's work. Another example for why they'd go on strike is, and this one pertains more to writers than anybody else, they've hit the picket lines and are actually currently on the picket lines over the issue of staffing levels, arguing that studios are not hiring enough writers or not providing them with adequate support and resources to do their jobs effectively. The modern industry has been referring to them as mini rooms. Strikes have also started over issues related to screen credit and attribution. For example, some have argued that they are not receiving proper credit for their work or that they are being denied credit for work that they believe that they are entitled to. Artists have also gone on strike over issues related to their health and safety, such as concerns about long working hours, lack of breaks, not being fed, or inadequate protections against sexual harassment and other forms of discrimination. In the modern world, and a big part of the current WGA strike, deals with streaming residuals. With the rise of streaming services, there has been a growing concern amongst writers that they are not receiving a fair share of the revenue generated by streaming for their work. Many claim that the streaming world has caused their residuals, which many rely on for a chunk of their income, to severely decrease. Frankly, as you'll soon see, residuals has been a fight for a very long time. So now that you've got a working knowledge of unions and why people might strike, let's get into their history in Hollywood. As is the case for many things in film, the origins of Hollywood's unions are found in the theater. Before 1893, early theatrical companies in the United States operated as more like cooperatives, with actors and directors sharing responsibility for jobs outside of their modern job descriptions. For example, this would include selling tickets, and the two would typically split profits equally. By the end of the century, however, touring troupes became more prominent. They generally operated out of New York and would travel the country by railroad. With this shift in where theater was happening, came more job specialization, which inevitably led to the exploitation of stagehands in many places. To protect themselves, this new group of specialized workers founded IATSE in 1893, which stands for the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, which covered all forms of behind-the-wings workers. Through the union, they managed to establish minimum pay rates, 8-hour workdays, and created formal outlines of each specific job. Also included in the agreement were rules to prevent managers from screwing over union members by hiring less qualified workers. If they wanted the quality workers, they had to hire the union people because that's where they all were. Failure to do so could lead to picketing of a theater, which could affect their bottom lines. Also, and we'll touch a little bit on this month, a lot of these unions had mob ties and you didn't want to F with the mob. While this was occurring, another form of entertainment was forming in several pockets of the world, and then the U.S. would eventually take root in Hollywood. As movies began to overtake theater as the dominant form of entertainment, the stage workers followed the work out west. IATSE Local 33 began organizing film workers across the Los Angeles area. But as the film industry grew, the union had trouble keeping up. It also faced competition from emerging craft unions representing specific job specialties. In 1916, producers formed the Motion Picture Producers Association, or MPPA, to fight all the unions forming in the industry. They're still around today, but now they're called the AMPTP. The first actors' union was the Screen Extras Guild, which was founded in 1915 by Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. The group was formed during a meeting at New York City's Hotel Astor. 300 members each paid dues of 50 cents per week, which was supposed to entitle them to unemployment benefits and a death benefit of $1,000. The group disbanded by 1918, however, because it had no authority to demand anything from directors or producers, and therefore could not try and enforce their demands. It's incredibly easy to get extras, it turns out, and they just didn't have the bargaining power. The Actors Equity Association was formed in 1919 as a successor to the Screen Extras Guilds. This union was formed by actors who felt they should have better working conditions and greater control over their careers. It would be overtaken by the Screen Actors Guild, or SAG, which we'll get to in a second. Before performers started to try and unionize, it was common for producers to demand that their talent work long hours without breaks or meals. Eventually, they got tired of it. For example, in 1915, on the Birth of a Nation shoot, director D.W. Griffith forced his actors to perform extremely dangerous stunts without any safety measures in place and then refused to pay them. The actors went on strike and were supported by other film workers in solidarity. This strike is considered to be the first Screen Actors strike in history and forced Griffith to cough up what he owed. In the late 20s, every bank in the East was throwing money at Hollywood, which allowed the moguls to build their studios and talent rosters for their moving pictures. When the movies were made and put into theaters, the revenue and profits belonged solely to the studio. Residuals were not really a thing. So if a film was super successful, a performer didn't get a bonus or anything like that. MGM head Louis B. Mayer and the other moguls knew that if the people physically making the movies unionized, that could mean trouble for their bottom lines. And they knew that the writers would be front and center demanding this because they were the ones creating the stories that the movies were. Also, they were the ones that were typically highly educated and tended to have the quote-unquote most radical ideas. Mayer, who was highly uneducated but had a good brain for economics, knew that his employees might soon ask for pensions, health insurance, and gasp residuals for their work. Mayer had been a poor Jewish child in Russia and had finally reached the top of the economic pile, achieving the apex of the American dream. He had no intention of letting go of one iota of his profits or power. Another thing that was founded to fight the unionization of the workers was something every single one of you have heard of. Spearheaded by Mayer, who in 1926 was probably the highest paid man in the United States, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was founded in an attempt to convince workers that they didn't need unions. And ooh, look at this shiny statue we'll give you if you stay out of those pesky unions. Spoiler alert, this didn't work out so great, though they still got shiny statues. The prosperity Mayer had enjoyed during the 1920s did not last for him or, frankly, any of the moguls. The Great Depression struck, Mayer's fortunes changed, and the movies became less lucrative as the country went into survival mode. During the Great Depression, the labor unions hemorrhaged members and were left quite weak, but things began to change in 1932 when President Herbert Hoover signed an important pro-union law called the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which removed important barriers against labor organizing. By the early 30s, actors, writers, and directors had formed their own unions and guilds, unfazed by the shiny Oscars their bosses tried to throw at them. And after this was signed, unions boomed everywhere, not just in Hollywood. In 1925, the Maskers had been formed by actors unhappy with grueling work hours at the studios. This would ultimately lead to the Screen Actors Guild being formed in 1933. Many high-profile actors refused to join SAG at first, and several were even given compensation by the studios to not join, unofficially, of course. But this attitude against unions changed when it came out that the producers had made an agreement amongst themselves to not bid competitively for talent. After a series of meetings about this amongst the actors, it took only 3 weeks for SAG membership to go from about 80 members to more than 4,000. Also in 1933, the SWG, or Screen Writers Guild, was officially formed. The foundations of this guild stretched back over a decade when a group of 12 screenwriters, disgruntled at the way they were being paid, formed the group to ensure their and their fellow writers were getting what they deserved. Back in those early days, their concerns boiled down to securing copyright protection for original story manuscripts and scenarios, to free American motion pictures from censorship, to insist on more cooperation between the producers of motion pictures and the Writers Guild members, to ensure they were receiving proper credit on the films, and to help its members secure adequate compensation and recognition for their efforts. Back then, to be a member of the Screenwriters Guild, you had to pay $60 a year, which is about $800 in today money. And this also included a membership into the Authors League of America as well. To get in, all applicants needed was to be nominated by two existing members of the guild and then to be approved by the board. The group would change its name to the WGA and differentiate between the East and West Coast writers in 1954. The DGA, or Directors Guild of America, was founded in 1936 after a small group of well-known directors joined together to protect their economic and creative rights. Soon, the DGA became the world's number one organization in representing directors and members of the directorial team, including assistant directors, unit production managers, associate directors, and production associates. Their modern deal with the studios includes the rule that if a director is not in their guild, they cannot direct a film for a major Hollywood studio. There are other guilds, but these are the only ones who have either gone on strike or threatened to in recent years. So to save you from me droning on and on and on and on and on about all the different kinds of guilds, we'll just leave it there for the time being. So at this point, you may be asking yourself, well, if they don't want to deal with the unions, then why doesn't the studios just hire non-union work, which typically means less skilled work? Well, if there was any rule breaking occurring within the studios, the unions would picket the studios and punish those who scabbed, aka crossed the picket lines, to work one of the protesters' jobs, essentially pressuring them not to do so and sometimes violently encouraging them not to do so. For example, if any writers, union or no, are caught working while this current strike is going on, they will be banned from the union for life, which will drastically affect their job prospects. Unions require solidarity to work, and if people try and lone wolf it, historically that's not gone over great. Again, remember, the mob was involved in a lot of this. The first major Hollywood strike occurred in 1936 in response to the loss of employment of Hollywood workers as a result of the use of official Army and Navy personnel and equipment in motion picture productions without cost to the studios. The government just kind of like let them use their stuff and people. And the Navy and Army was paying the soldiers' salaries, so the studios didn't have to. It was reported that the studios were saving about $1 million in performance costs alone by doing this. Today, that would be over $21 million. That's production on like 4 Blumhouse movies. Or I think they're still $5 million each. I don't actually know. The Screen Actors Guild cited unfair competition. Of course, they couldn't beat working for free and went on strike. The union boycotted the Oscars that year for, quote, selling the actor down the river. By spring of 1937, in parts thanks to recognition by IATSE, SAG, now known as SAG-AFTRA to include the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists Performers, became the official union for actor representation in the U.S., which it remains to this day. On May 15, 1937, the Guild had its first contract with the studio signed, ensuring a set daily rate for performers. Guess the studios realized that they were going to actually need actors if they intended to make anything other than military-themed films. The next major strike to occur was the 1941 Disney animator strike, which we're covering at length next week. If you're a big fan of Walt Disney, you're going to get a bit of an eye-opener. But this four-month standoff between Walt's animators and Disney over pay and the implementation of a hierarchy system that barred certain employees from accessing certain amenities on the lot left the studio gutted of much of its talent when the dust settled. The Animation Guild today is a branch of IATSE, by the by. In 1945, the Black Friday strike occurred outside of Warner Brothers, which we are covering in a couple of weeks. This strike was so chaotic and convoluted and violent that it spawned anti-union sentiments throughout town, inadvertently leading to the blacklist a little bit later on. Soon, pro-union would be the same as saying communist in the eyes of many producers and the movie moguls in town. To give you kind of an outline of what happened, just to prepare you for 2 weeks from now, the Conference of Studio Unions, or CSU, was, at the time, an international union led by United Painters organizer Herbert Sorrell, who you'll hear a lot about in the next couple weeks. CSU represented the Carpenters, United Painters, the Screen Cartoonists Guild, a guild of electricians, laborers, set decorators, amongst a few others. 77 set decorators broke away from IATSE to form the Society of Motion Picture Interior Decorators, or SMPID, and negotiated an independent contract with producers in 1937. The SMPID then joined CSU in 1943. After the producers stalled the negotiations for 9 months, IATSE questioned CSU's jurisdiction over the set directors, which led to a further 5-month delay while the CSU and IATSE fought over jurisdiction. Technically, they were doing about the same thing. When the producers refused to acknowledge that the CSU had jurisdiction over the set decorators in February 1945, it set the stage for the strike. This strike dragged on for several months, leading to a standoff at Warner Brothers between the picketing union members and the people crossing the lines. Things got violent, and the altercation would become known as Hollywood's Black Friday. Following the strike in 1946, the CSU would be locked out of studios by the producers. IATSE became the prevailing craftsman guild, which it, again, pretty much remains to this day. By the late 1940s, early 1950s, the unions took their biggest hit, specifically the Writers Guild, as a result of the Red Scare and the McCarthy hearings on communism in Hollywood. It led to several writers being jailed for pleading their First Amendment rights and caused a blacklist of hundreds of performers, barring them from making a living in their industry. The government's probe into Hollywood's communist influence would not turn out a single shred of proof that communists were using motion pictures to secretly spread their propaganda, but despite that pesky little fact, it still destroyed probably thousands of lives in the process and ruined Hollywood's creative output for the better part of a decade. For more on the McCarthy hearings, the HUAC trial, all that, check out my June 2022 episodes on The Blacklist. In the aftermath of the HUAC hearings, labor unions like SAG, DGA, and WGA were forced to turn their backs on several of their own members and allowed studios to omit blacklisted performers from the credits of future films. Failure to do so would have had them fingered as secret communist organizations and put into jeopardy their entire membership body. So they just really didn't. They were kind of voluntold to do this. Between 1945 and 1960, only one strike occurred, the 1952 actors' strike, which dealt more with television and ended with actors getting residuals whenever a show they appeared on was rerun on television. In 1960, now that the HUAC committee had lost its power and influence, Hollywood saw two strikes, one of which was led by none other than Ronald Reagan, oh the irony. If you don't know or don't remember, he was a big accuser during the HUAC hearings. The 1960s actor strike was over performers, specifically film actors in this case, is desires to receive residuals for their work, which was a non-starter for the producers as the film industry had tanked in financial viability since the advent of television. Producers also couldn't fathom why these greedy actors thought they deserved to be paid multiple times for doing a job one time. When talks broke down on March 7th, 1960, the actors walked off set. After 5 weeks of protesting, it was negotiated that actors would receive residuals on films going forward, but there would be no residuals for any studio on films produced before 1948 unless there was already a deal stipulated in a contract. In lieu of residuals for films made between 1948 and 1959, the producers agreed to a one-time payout of $2.25 million to SAG, which the guild used as seed money for new union health insurance and pension plans for its members. By the by, residuals never expire and go to the next of kin or estate upon that performer's death. So these people who protested this back in the 1960s, who probably aren't around anymore because that was like 60 years ago, their families are still getting residuals because of what they did back then. A few months earlier, in January of 1960, the writers went on strike for 146 days, the second longest strike in the industry's history. The settlement for this strike included having the studios pay into the writers' pension and health funds in the amount of $600,000. They also agreed to give up 5% of the studio's income from pre-1960 movies that aired on television. On post-1960 movies, writers got 2% of income. If the film was shown on pay TV, however, they would receive no residuals. The minimum rates were also increased to $350 a week, and writers would get a 10% raise for the first 2 years and then 5% for the next year and a half. Screenwriters striked again in 1973, this time mostly just against television producers who weren't super, like, in a rush to fix it because the strike kicked off just before the summer hiatuses did, giving them some time to bargain. Once again, the writers saw wage increases as well as deals involving the emerging pay TV and video markets. 7 years later, the actors were back on picket lines, this time demanding 35% increases in salaries and a higher cut of home video profits as that market began to boom. Now, some of you are probably thinking this 35% increase is benefiting the Harrison Fords and Meryl Streeps of the industry, but in reality, this was to try and get a living wage for the gigging actor, the ones you kind of recognize from that one TV show, because he was also on that other TV show and then, like, died randomly in that movie you saw. It was mostly for them. At the time, those actors' base rate was $225 a day, about $872 in today money. But you have to keep in mind that actors are freelancers and giggers, and they're just not going to be working as much as, you know, the more famous actors, and they're not going to be compensated as well. By paying them a higher rate, it would ensure that an actor could stretch the money longer between gigs and hopefully increase their quality of life. Of course, that always brings into question, is that really the studio's problem? Guess that depends on your personal philosophies about this. And this month, I am Switzerland to convey this information as unbiased as possible, so you're not getting my opinion on that, unfortunately. I know you're heartbroken. This strike lasted 3.5 months, affecting network cable as the strike ran from July to October. The actors got close to their wage increase, 32.5%, that's not bad, but they only got a 4% cut of home video. In 1981 and 1985, the writers went on strike again over the pay TV markets, but again, not much change occurred as home video at this time was still in its infancy and therefore an untested market overall. This worked in the producers' favors, and while there were some percentage points given, it was nowhere near what the writers had initially come to the table with. The shortest ever strike in Hollywood history occurred in 1987. The TGA was on the picket lines for 3 hours and 5 minutes over residuals. Producers had tried to do away with residuals altogether to save money, and the TGA wasn't having none of that. The producers backed down, keeping the system intact. The longest showbiz strike occurred in 1988 when the writers once again walked off the job over, residuals, but also over wanting more creative control over their scripts, for example, having a say in who gets cast as a character. And producers wanted to cut costs, but the writers were, unsurprisingly, vehemently against this. After months of negotiations, the writers did get some creative control over original work and slight changes to the residuals models, but again, wasn't quite what they wanted, and they were on strike for 22 weeks. Before this week, the last major strike in Hollywood was the 2007-2008 WGA strike, which virtually shut down television and film production from November to February. We're covering this bad boy in a few weeks. Amongst the many demands from both sides regarding the writers' new deals, there were several key issues of this time, including DVD residuals, union jurisdiction over animation and reality TV, and compensation for quote-unquote new media, which is content written for distribution through the emerging digital technologies like YouTube and, you know, now what we kind of know more as like streaming stuff. So now that you see Hollywood is no stranger to striking, let's go into what's going on right now. On April 18th, 2023, 97.85% of members of the WGA voted to strike if they failed to reach a satisfactory agreement with the AMPTP by May 1st. The AMPTP in this case was negotiating on behalf of Amazon, Apple, Netflix, NBC Universal, Paramount, Netflix, Sony, Warner Brothers, and Disney. A deal was not struck. So on May 2nd at 12:01 a.m., the writers went on strike. So what are they striking over this time? The main focus this time around is, once again, residuals, this time stemming from streaming media. The WGA claims that the AMPTP's share of such residuals has cut out much of writers' average incomes compared to what they were a decade ago. As streaming has grown in popularity, writers have seen their residuals take a pretty massive hit, as these are calculated at a far lower rate, if at all, compared to syndication, which isn't really how people really watch reruns anymore. Seriously, if you're under the age of 40, when's the last time you watched a rerun of a show like on cable? Exactly. So if you're streaming them, writers aren't and performers aren't getting as much of a cut as they would be as if you were watching it on cable. This is coupled with TV series with less episodes being produced and writers' rooms shrinking in size, essentially forcing writers to do more work for less pay. The WGA wants mini rooms banned from television production altogether. Writers also want formal regulations put on the rapidly emerging AI modules. They want to ensure that AI like ChatGPT are only used as a tool to help research or facilitate script ideas and not to be used to actually write or edit a script. They want to ensure that remains a human's job. This is very likely going to be only the first of several strikes that will deal with AI technology, as it has the ability to rock many different industries. As long as the strike is happening, the WGA has informed its members that, quote, writers cannot do any writing, revising, pitching, or discussing future projects with companies that are members of the AMPTP. This does not affect non-union writers, but if a writer is caught working in place of a union person, they will be banned from the union forever. Right now, the major disruption to productions are only being seen on the television side. The late night shows are shut down as they are written daily, so there's no way to bank episodes. Same goes for Saturday Night Live, as that show is written the week of. In their time slots, reruns will play until further notice. It's going to take longer for movies to feel the strike or for you to even notice it as a consumer, as their production times are longer, and as long as they have crew willing to cross picket lines, this is not considered scabbing, as crew members are not members of the WGA, they can continue to be made so long as no rewrites or writers are present on set or anywhere. They can't do rewrites at all right now. In fact, many studios bank scripts for months in anticipation of this strike occurring. The writers are currently striking at all 9 major studios that are part of the AMPTP Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. As someone who works very near to where one of the picket lines is, it's very loud, but I understand it's a necessary evil for them, but I get sensory overload really easily, so noise-canceling headphones have been clutch the last few days. I'll give updates as the strike goes on, but that's basically where we're at right now. As of Wednesday, there have been no plans for talks to resume to make this end. But after the painful pandemic years, I don't think this is going to go on for a super long time. Once people begin feeling this strike in their pockets, deals will get made. Until then, the writers will picket, laptops shut, pencils down. And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media, where I also post photos for each episode. At Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account, which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You could check it out at the link in the show notes. I've actually started going through the Criterion Collection, and I have a full Criterion Collection list on my account if you want to check that out. It's 1,300 movies, and it was a lot of work. I probably should have been doing other things. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there. So if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I very much appreciate it. There's also the Buy Me a Coffee. I actually forgot to drink coffee today because I woke up early and was watching the coronation, and now it's 2 p.m. and I've not done that. But normally, normally I have coffee. I've also got merch. Check it out at the link in the show notes. Next week, we'll look into the animator strike at Disney that shook up Walt's Utopia. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap.